From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, there's a liberal trend in the historically conservative country music industry. Then when it comes to animation technology, a lot can change in 14 years. So while the superheroes from Incredibles 2 haven't aged, they're also not quite the same.
The characters actually look more like we wanted them to look in the first film. People should feel like they're the same characters, but they're actually quite a bit improved.
And in a downtown LA storefront, you can play, not see a play, just play. All that coming right up.
KPCC supporters include Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy-eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. There is a term in country music for people who suffer fan backlash for speaking out as liberal. It's called being Dixie Chicked. And that refers to what happened to the band the Dixie Chicks in 2003 after they denounced the Iraq War and said they were ashamed that the president of the United States was from Texas. And that president, of course, was George W. Bush. That was 15 years ago, and things seem to be shifting politically and culturally. In the wake of the Las Vegas shooting, liberal voices are now getting louder in Nashville. Marissa Moss is a freelance music journalist who's written about all of this in Billboard. I called her in Nashville today, and we started with why there was such a backlash against the Dixie Chicks 15 years ago.
There were several things going on at once, was that they weren't getting played on country radio, but the Dixie Chicks still had support from forces within Nashville. I'm sure if you ask any handful of people within music world in Nashville proper if they still believed in the Dixie Chicks, and they would tell you yes. But then you had Clear Channel refusing to play them, while at the same time Clear Channel was also extremely busy trying to give a platform to their hosts that were speaking up very aggressively in support of the war in Iraq, which is what the Chicks were speaking against. So there was this impression that the whole world was burning Dixie Chicks albums and that Nashville was completely against the Chicks, which now if you look at the fact that they've been able to sell out arenas and do this huge tour, it can't really be true.
So around the same time that the Dixie Chicks were effectively blacklisted, a group called the Music Row Democrats started. Who were they? What were they responding to? And what is their legacy today?
They started out, you know, just a handful of people and grew to be, you know, I think, several thousand associated people. Is everyone from, I spoke to publicists and managers and talent agents, artists, songwriters. Their whole agenda was to, you know, register people to vote and galvanize people within the Nashville music industry to speak out for liberal candidates. And I think once Obama was elected, it kind of gave everyone a little bit of a false sense of security.
Last October, a gunman in Las Vegas opened fire on the audience at the Route 91 Country Music Festival, killing 58 and wounding more than 800. How has that changed the conversation and the historic relationship between country music and the NRA? And how do you see it evolving since then?
Some people would say that it, from an outside perspective, maybe hasn't changed that much. But within Nashville, I think it has had a huge impact. What we had here in Nashville was an arm of the NRA called NRA Country. And they would work with tons of major country artists to do promotional campaigns. And they would often sort of prey on people as they were in the earlier stages of their career, make them an NRA country artist and, you know, give them more of a platform. And you had artists like Luke Combs and Florida Georgia Line and, you know, well-known artists in Nashville aligning themselves with NRA country. And now it's extremely difficult to find out any artists who are working with NRA country these days.
You write that even though the political climate is changing, there are still obstacles to keeping people from talking and espousing what we'll call liberal positions, and that is record labels and radio stations. Why is that? What are the consequences? What are they afraid of?
People are sort of sick of this saying here in Nashville, but it's the fear of getting Dixie Chicked. And what people mean when they say that is that you'll say something controversial or political and you will be not played on radio. radio is so vitally important in country music that it's a legitimate concern. If I were an artist, especially if I were a female artist that were already having an enormous amount of trouble getting played on country radio at all, because we know that women aren't played nearly as equally as men on country radio. So if you're a woman and you want to speak out, you're already at a disadvantage. But one thing that I talked about in that story was their heads of labels that could support their artists speaking out more because their beliefs align with maybe what, you know, the causes they want to talk about. They want to talk about gun control. Their, you know, political donations match up with that.
Is there a potential that the backlash can go the other way, that if the Dixie Chicks were essentially blacklisted for espousing anti-George W. Bush opinions, that, you know, Canadian singer Shania Twain earlier this year said that if she were American, she would have voted for Donald Trump, and she got in a lot of trouble for those remarks?
Yeah, and I think that's something interesting that's starting to happen now is people were very angry and, you know, swearing that they'll never go to her show again. And, you know, it's conservative people coming out either making a, you know, a sympathetic statement about Trump or aligning with a conservative cause. And that's making people almost do the reverse Dixie Chick to them.
The way that fans of any music genre access music is evolving. They can get music on Spotify or iTunes, but a lot of people still listen to radio. And I'm wondering if the ownership of some of the bigger country music radio stations is, if those owners are in some ways not totally aligned with this liberal trend within the music industry.
Country is such a unique animal because you have so much of the power in the industry contained by, you know, this handful of 200 radio stations across the country. The funny thing is that the sales in country don't quite line up with what's getting played at the top of country radio. And it's very easy to say, oh, you know, we can take the power, we should take the power away from radio. But right now we're not there yet because you're not getting played on radio. You're not getting tours. If you're not getting tours, you're not getting brand partnerships, all the things you need to do to survive as an artist. And, you know, I haven't seen Spotify sort of take the reins and kind of help step in where country radio has been failing yet, you know, particularly when it comes to women.
Marissa Moss is a freelance music writer. She is the author of the article in Billboard, "The Country Music Industry is More Liberal Than It Lets On. Will More Start to Speak Up?" Marissa joined us from Nashville. Marissa, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, superhero sequels are nothing new in Hollywood, but a 14-year gap between the original and the follow-up is a new twist.
KBCC podcasts are supported by Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series, and Freeform's Grown-ish, produced by ABC Signature Studios. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Comedy Series, Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for Yara Shahidi, and Outstanding Contemporary Costumes. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. It's been 14 years since Brad Bird's first Incredibles movie, but instead of aging the characters up in his Pixar sequel, the writer and director of Incredibles 2 picks up with the Parr family pretty much where the first film left off. This time, it's Helen Parr, or Elastigirl, voiced by Holly Hunter, who's on a mission to save the world, while her husband, Mr. Incredible, voiced by Craig T. Nelson, struggles to keep a handle on the couple's kids. Samuel L. Jackson returns as Frozone, and Bird is back, too, as the voice of Edna Mode, the costume designer with a knack for tough love pep talks.
You are Elastigirl!
My God, pull yourself together!
What will you do? Is this a question?
You will show him you remember that he is Mr. Incredible, and you will remind him who you are. Well, you know where he is. Go, confront the problem. Fight. Win! And call me when you get back, darling. I enjoy our visits.
When I spoke with Brad Bird recently, I asked him how and when he came up with the idea for Incredibles 2.
I had the core idea, which was that Helen gets the assignment rather than Bob. I had that notion occurred to me when I was promoting the first film. And I also had the unopened present of Jack-Jack. The audience knows that he has multiple powers, but the Parr family does not.
Bob, listen to this.
Bob and Helen and the kids don't know that Jack is a sort of a Swiss Army knife of powers. And in this movie, we get to play with that idea a lot. But the rest of it, getting it to interface with a superhero story with the, you know, villain and all that, that kept changing, you know. And I was working on other things, Ratatouille and Mission Impossible. I did my first live action film, and then Tomorrowland. And anyway, I was busy. And I kept tinkering with the idea in my brain. And Pixar and John Lasseter were respectful enough to go, well, you know, when he's ready, he'll talk to us. And I looked up, and suddenly it was almost too long had been since the first film, and I thought I should get up off my ass and do this, because the most fun I ever had making a movie in my experience so far, I've only made 6 now, was the original Incredibles. And so I always wanted to return to these characters, and I didn't intend for it to be so long, but certainly nobody can think that it's a cash grab, because it's a really ill-timed cash grab if it is.
What about the actors? When you finally were able to call them and say, this is going to happen, what were those conversations like? And were they among the people who were lobbying to finally get a chance to tell another incredible story?
Well, the only one who was really lobbying was Sam, who was just basically saying to people, yeah, we're going to do another Incredibles 2.
Honey!
What?
Where's my super suit?
What?
Where is my super suit?
I, put it away!
Where?
Why do you need to know?
I need it!
So Sam, you know, is a force of nature, and it's kind of like when Sam started to say that, I started to feel bad that I, like dereliction of duty, that I hadn't gotten it going yet. So I kind of kicked an idea around and talked to Pixar, and they were liking the notion. And so we just kind of got the band back together, and it was pretty great.
Pixar has always done incredibly well in terms of coming up with stories, but it also is at its heart a technology company. And I'm wondering how the evolution of the tools that you have as a filmmaker have changed what you're able to do or what you're able to do differently or better compared to, say, 14 years ago. How does your toolbox evolve, and how does that allow you to do something visually that maybe you couldn't do quite the same way when you did the first film?
When we were first making films, I mean, I started right after Toy Story 2. I came to Pixar when Monsters, Inc. was in production. And every film at that early stage had something unique and easily understandable to talk about when the film came out. Like with Monsters, Inc., it was hair. We can finally do fur, you know, and so there's lots of furry monsters, and we do fur now. Look at the fur. And the press would write down fur, you know. And then the next film was Finding Nemo, and it's like water, fish. We do water and fish now. Look at the light going through the water. And when it came time to do Incredibles, it was kind of like what we were doing was we'd already done before, but we'd never done it to the degree that we had done it with Incredibles. In other words, Incredibles was everything. The first Incredibles was everything that computers sucked at. Computers were terrible at humans, and the humans are notoriously weak before Incredibles. The two characters I think who avoided that were the little girl from Monsters. I thought she came off well. And the toy fixer, repair guy in Toy Story 2, who was taken from Jerry's Game, directed by Jan Pinkava, and put into service in that feature.
There you go. He's for display only.
Those were the only two humans that I thought were really good humans. And everyone, you know, I'll be a little bit critical here and say I thought every other studio that was doing CG animation at the time also failed at humans. And Pixar had done the only two ones that I thought came off. And with The Incredibles, we had nothing but humans. That's all we had. And we had hair. And one of the key characters in the film, she hid behind her hair. So the hair was a character thing. And we had to have hair that worked. And we didn't know how to do it. And we, you know, hair and fabric and water and fire and humans, everything that, and cloth. Everything that computers were bad at, that film had in spades. And so we had to kind of do a D-Day landing on all this stuff to pull off the first film. And what's changed is everything is still challenging. It's still challenging to tell a story. But if you can imagine it and you know that you want it and you don't change your mind, they can get it for you now, and they can do it well. And in Incredibles 2, the characters actually look more like we wanted them to look in the first film. People should feel like they're the same characters, but they're actually quite a bit improved.
We're talking with Brad Bird. He is the writer and director of Incredibles 2. When you're making a sequel to a live-action film or maybe the 10th season of a TV series, your actors age, and you have to generally recognize that as a filmmaker who's making an animated film, you can make a choice about whether or not your characters are going to age, whether or not they're going to be pretty much where we left them. How do you go about deciding if there is a right way to proceed, and what were the conversations that you had with your creative team about that decision?
Well, back when I was still reading social media... I don't read like chat rooms and talkbacks are sort of toxic and I don't read them anymore. But years ago when I was kind of still poking around there, there were a lot of sort of fan theories about Incredibles 2 and, hey, you know, you got to have, you know, Jack in high school and blah, 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 blah. And it was like... I sat there and I went, no, the essential conceit of Incredibles is that these superpowers comment on people's roles in the family. And so that was the original idea. And that was sort of an epiphany I had, was that I was looking for new superpowers. And then I quickly realized every superpower that is not ridiculous has been done by somebody somewhere. And I quickly realized that's not what I'm interested in. I'm interested in the family.
What does anyone in this family know about normal?
Now, wait a minute, young lady.
We act normal, Mom. I want to be normal. The only normal one is Jack, and he's not even toilet trained.
I thought, what if the superheroes commented on the role in the family? So fathers are expected to be strong, so I made him super strong. Mothers are pulled in 12 different directions at once, so I had her be elastic. Teenagers are defensive and insecure, so I had her able to throw force fields and go invisible. And 10-year-old boys are adrenaline junkies, so I gave him super speed. And babies are unknowns, so the babies can be anything. You know, and so that was part of the idea, and that shifts the minute you age them up.
Right.
It becomes, suddenly that doesn't work as well. And so I was not interested in aging them up. You know, I mean, I can sit there and conjecture of what they would be like if they were older like anyone else, but it wasn't where I wanted to tell a story.
Brad Bird, thanks for taking time out, and no spoilers.
Great, you did it. Thank you.
Incredibles 2 opens in theaters on June 15th. Coming up, a kind of immersive theater experience in downtown LA that reminds tightly wound adults like me how to let loose and just play. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. So on a recent Saturday night, I went to downtown Los Angeles to play, not to a play, but to play. I didn't exactly know what I was in for. All I was told was to wear black and leave my cell phone behind. When I stepped into the little downtown storefront, I was handed an instruction sheet with the most important rule being no talking aloud. Then I was given a small chip of ice. Once it melted, I was invited to crawl through a tunnel and entered a series of connected rooms. And for the next 90 minutes or so, I and a couple of dozen other hipsters just played. You can paint on a wall. You can type out a story on an old typewriter. You can put on makeup, put it on someone else, throw on a costume and pose for a photo, collapse in a room filled with hundreds of stuffed animals, or challenge some stranger to a game of Twister. Play, as it's called, is the brainchild of Olivia Hamilton, and it happens every Saturday night in downtown Los Angeles. Hamilton is an actress who appeared in La La Land. She first worked in finance and consulting, but didn't find those jobs fulfilling. So she started taking acting classes, and those led to the idea to start Play.
The types of things you do in an acting class are not just like exercises for the craft of acting in a scene. A lot of it's just like opening up your instrument and getting in touch with all different parts of your personality, which from my experience working at McKinsey and other business jobs are pretty much suppressed. So I was doing that and my little sister was living with me in my studio apartment and we had the idea, let's do something like that. Let's create an experience that takes non-actors on a similar journey of opening up and getting in touch with their creative, playful, childlike self. So we sent out a paperless post to 8 people who didn't know each other and invited them to our apartment, which was 500 square feet. And we did what we called Experience Thursday. And then we had created kind of the first play program, taking exercises from things I was doing in acting class and also things we did when we were kids together that we loved, like paperback skits.
And what was it that you hoped and maybe even saw people who didn't have a lot of creativity in their lives get out of being a creative person?
People kind of lit up. People described feeling kind of like relaxed, like as if they'd had a couple drinks, but they hadn't had any. And then most of all, I felt like what I saw and what I continue to see with people is just sort of a shift in self-identity. I think a lot of people tell themselves, I'm not creative. I'm not that. I don't dance in public or whatever. And then after a play experience, they're like, wait, okay, I am kind of silly. I can do that. Like my sense of self is now expanded and I'm more creative than I realized.
A lot of people come in to play, I suspect, as individuals or as couples. And yet there is a group dynamic that happens.
Yes.
And then this becomes kind of an organic body that starts to do things together. Does every play take a different shape? And do you see these individuals coalescing into a group in different ways? And is there always kind of a discernible tipping point where they start working together as opposed to individually?
That's a good question. So we always have kind of an individual opening art experience where people are kind of with their friends probably or by themselves. I guess the transition to doing stuff as a group definitely happens when the facilitators kind of come in and start guiding people. For the silent play experiment, it does start in that first 45 minutes because we added some prompts and some language in our welcome note to encourage people to, you know, work with people they don't know. But I think it kind of depends on the individual. Some people come in and they're like, this is my jam. When they just go up to random people they don't know and they're like interacting with them and it's so comfortable and easy for them. And other people come in and they want to sit in the corner. And maybe that person is grabbed and invited, but it sort of just depends on the type of person you are.
So much of acting as a profession is about rejection. It's about going in, doing your best. And there are thousands of actors who are trying out for, you know, a handful of parts any given hour of any given day. And yet it seems like something that's important to you is that there's no judgment. There's no evaluation of whether or not you're doing a good job, whether or not you're going to get the call back. Is that in part in reaction to the reality of what it means to be a working actor or somebody who is trying to get work as an actor?
I guess the connection I would make is that oftentimes when I'm acting, I do my best work as an actor when I am not afraid to fail and I'm not afraid to actually not do it right. And so that to me is like related to this like fostering an environment where no one can do anything wrong because then you get the most amazing, best creative stuff. But the no judgment thing is really just like sort of an invitation to everybody to turn off that judgmental part for both themselves and for other people. And I think it's sort of essential in creating an environment where people can expand.
Why is it important that it's silent? Why is that critical? And when did you start making sure that that was the rule?
So it's not critical. This is our first experience that we've done silent, over 5 years of doing them. And it's actually really challenging because when we don't do it silently, I can, you know, we can give guidance live. Now, like, you're looking into someone's eyes and imagine this, or, you know, you just have a lot more flexibility even in the room to do spontaneous things when it's not silent. But the reason that we experimented with it was our whole goal in creating these experiences is to get people out of their heads. And we were like, what if we don't give anyone the option to even talk at all? Like, how would that, would people be able to kind of get more dropped in?
So you did Wall Street type stuff and consulting type stuff before you started doing play. Do you think imaginative play can be useful to people in similar fields of work, lawyers, doctors, economists, whatever?
I think it's essential. I think that play is a movement that's going to be like fitness, basically. In 10 years, we're all going to be talking about working out our play muscles and our creativity muscles, I hope, if I'm successful in spreading the word.
Olivia, great to see you.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Play is this Saturday at 7 p.m. and again at 9:30 p.m., then every other Saturday in June at 9:30 p.m. For more information, go to theframe.org. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.